Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this podcast series, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentives, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated. They're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I am Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD and former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to that, I worked in policy and finance, and my expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. I'm joined today by my co-host, Vikram Shyam. Vic, over to you.
Thanks, Marco. Hey, everyone. I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for over 15 years, and I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. So we use strategic foresight to look for societal problems that exist either now or will exist 25 to 50 years from now, and that aerospace and aeronautics may help to alleviate those problems and basically to create a better future for everyone. So we like to hear from very diverse group of people around the world to inform our foresight practice.
Splendid. Thank you, Vic. And our guest today is Dr. Julia Aimone-Marsan. She's an innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship strategist and ecosystem builder with more than 15 years of experience in economic analysis and advice, policy dialogue, research, capacity building. During her career, Julia has advised a broad range of public and private sector leaders, senior policymakers, government officials, international organizations, and other stakeholders globally across ASEAN, the Indo-Pacific, the European Union, North and Latin America, Africa, MENA, and the G20. She is currently the head of startups and inclusion at the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia. Prior to joining the Institute, Julia worked as an innovation economist at the OECD. She was appointed as co-chair of the G20 Startup 20 Inclusion Task Force under the G20 India in 2023, and she's a member of the G20 Startup 20 ESG Task Force under G20 Brazil in 2024. Dr. Aimone-Marsan is a member of the World Economic Forum Expert Network and the Strategic Intelligence Community. She is also an associate of the Edinburgh Futures Institute. Julia has published several books, academic articles, and research reports. And this brief bio just gives you a glimpse of everything she has already accomplished. Julia, we are delighted to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much to you and Marco for having me here. I'm really thrilled to discuss ecosystemic futures with you too.
Splendid. Julia, do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about your current position and how it fits in your career so far? And in the meanwhile, maybe also give some context to the audience as to what different international organizations are doing, the activities especially that you've been involved in, touching both on startups, innovation, but also sustainability and development goals.
As you can imagine, innovation and innovation policy is becoming a top policy priority for many countries around the world. At the end, innovation-driven growth is more sustainable and more long-term. Therefore, many multilateral agencies are actively supporting governments, both individual governments, in some cases subnational entities, or even shaping and trying to lead multilateral processes to promote both the creation and the growth of innovation ecosystems, but also startup creation and the transformation of the economy, technology adoption, and so on and so forth. So innovation policy and trying to contribute to the building of innovation ecosystems across many different regions in the world is actually an important part of the activities of many multilateral organizations. My current organization area now, I'm based in Asia, in Indonesia, but before I was doing a similar job at another international organization called OECD. And I mean, many other multilateral agencies around the world are very committed to support the development of innovation ecosystem, both in high-income economies, but also in lower-income economies and emerging markets.
I've also started my career in international organizations, though the one I started in, the International Monetary Fund, is probably the one that is least involved in sustainability efforts, or at least it was when I worked there. So I have a limited direct experience on this, whereas you are really at the forefront of this. Julia, let me then now move on to the following question. The dominant perception for those of us who are sitting in the US or in Europe is that innovation happens in advanced economies. We associate innovation with government institutions like NASA or the whole Silicon Valley ecosystem. And so we have the impression that all that happens in emerging markets is that emerging markets at best copy and follow the innovation which is carried out in advanced economies. But you know from your own firsthand experience that things are quite differently. So can you start by giving us a reality check on this and a broad sense of how much innovation is actually happening in emerging markets?
Absolutely. And thank you for this question. You already mentioned leading innovation organization or ecosystem in your question, the Silicon Valley, NASA. These are institutions and ecosystem strongly associated with the US. There are, of course, many innovation hotspots in Europe. But at the same time, we need to recognize that the geography of innovation is changing and is changing very rapidly. Let me perhaps quote a couple of figures. If we take patent counts, this is a statistic that is traditionally associated with innovation activity, even if it is an imperfect measure of innovation. Patents typically tend to capture R&D-based innovation, the type of innovation that happens in a lab. And this is not, it is not the only form of innovation that we have out there. But nevertheless, even if you take this proxy and once again, imperfect measure of innovation activity, and we look at the evolution of patent counts over the last few decades, what we basically see is that until the early 2000s, more or less 95% of patent activities was concentrating within the OECD, basically a group of high income or just to simplify, developed nations. Then fast forward 20 years, and in 2019, the global share of patenting activity at the OECD dropped by almost 20 points. I mean, 76% of patenting activities was concentrated in this region of the world, meaning basically that there were other innovation hotspots that were emerging at the same time. So 20 percentage points drop in 20 years, meaning once again that other regions in the world are now becoming increasingly very important players in the global geography of innovation. This doesn't mean that we should forget about what's happening in the US, Europe, Japan, or other well-established players. It is extremely important, and the Silicon Valley remains the most famous innovation ecosystem in the world. But at the same time, we need to be aware that innovation is more geographically distributed, and very important players in emerging markets are emerging and are emerging very fast. I'm lacking, I happen to kind of...
Julia, I'll interrupt you just for a second for a clarification. You are mentioning that the drop in the share of patents going to OECD countries is very striking. The question that immediately comes to mind, is that very much influenced by the greater role of China, or is it more geographically distributed?
Absolutely. I mean, China is an important player. I mean, now it's a well-established innovation giant. So certainly, I mean, this drop is partly a China story, but it is not only a China story. So the point I really want to make is that there is now a different distribution of innovation hotspots around the world, US, Europe, Northeast Asia. Northeast Asia includes both China, Japan, and South Korea. But again, we are really seeing the emergence of other hotspots in other locations in emerging Asia, notably Southeast Asia, places like Indonesia, Malaysia, or other high growth economies, but also very much India. India is a very big country, more than 1 billion population. And when you read about India, when you visit India, it's striking the fact that issues such as startups, entrepreneurship, business creation, technology adoption are becoming very important policy priorities, but are really transforming the way the economy is basically, growing. And I mean, and this transformation is taking place in a very clear way. And this is just two examples of two different areas within Asia. But, you know, the same is true if we look at countries, for instance, in Africa. Places like Nigeria or South Africa are likely to become very interesting startup ecosystems in the years and decades to come. If we look at Latin America, I mean, absolutely a place like Brazil should be under the radar because it's becoming a leading country when it comes to fintech innovations and other type of entrepreneurship and startup creation. And let's not forget about the fact that in the Middle East, places like the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia are placing big investments on innovation, entrepreneurship and technology, including artificial intelligence. So this is just to give you an idea about the fact that once again, the geography of innovation is becoming more diversified and varied. And I think it's very, very important for listeners to this podcast or innovation watchers around the world to be aware of these mega trends, because they are really likely to impact the way global innovation networks are shaping up as we speak and in years to come.
So I guess to add on to the, so you mentioned a nice breakdown globally of the patent ecosystem. I'm wondering how much of this is driven by the type of innovation that happens, for example, in the US and the places that the funding is going to in terms of basic research versus integrating existing solutions versus the market demand. So, for example, if you look at the breakdown, if you zoom in one level further into the types of patents in, let's say, Asia versus the US, it might be that there's a demand for more like accessories and textiles, household goods, which maybe the patents that existed before in, let's say, US and OECD countries don't really cover those kinds of things. So there's a potential for larger patent development, maybe in some of these other countries, and slowly maybe that'll plateau. Or are you seeing this as more of a sustained, is this like a funding push, or there's like a more deliberate mechanism behind it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't now be too much fixated around patent counts. I mean, I took that as an example that is really showing how, I mean, innovation networks are diversifying. But I think you're raising a very interesting point that is the one that, I mean, first of all, ecosystems are very different depending on the different locations we are discussing. And you're also already pointing to the fact different actors within ecosystems, especially innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem, can be a very leading and important role to play. First of all, because this podcast is called Ecosystem in Future, and because I've been working on innovation ecosystem for basically all my career since after my PhD, when we talk about an innovation ecosystem, we need to remember that it's basically something that is composed by actors that are important player in innovation. Think about research centers, universities, public agencies like ministries or local agencies that are somehow making policies around innovation, and of course, and very importantly, the private sector, startups, high growth firms, but also well-established businesses. And when we talk about ecosystems, something that is extremely important is actually the relationship amongst these different actors. So a well-functioning ecosystem is a bit like an orchestra. Different players are playing different instruments, but somehow they manage to produce a harmonious sound. And you just mentioned something about the role of a scientific organization. And of course, they play a very important role. And in the production of innovation, also the relationship and the interactions between these public sector organization, science organization, and the business sector are very important. And what we can see in some of the countries I was just describing, some of the regions I was talking about, is that the capacity or the quality of this science and research organization vary a lot. If we look, for instance, at Southeast Asia, the region where I'm based, Singapore is an innovation powerhouse. It always ranks among the first countries globally, according to the WIPO Global Innovation Index, and it has leading universities. But surrounding countries, other countries in Southeast Asia, so emerging markets in that region in the world, they don't have institution, research and science institution as strong as Singapore has. And in this market, what we have been observing is really that to some extent, innovation was really driven by the startup community or the business sector. There are interesting examples of entrepreneurs that in some cases studied abroad, and they were really quick and smart to understand that there were markets to be filled in. And they developed some innovation that have become now super apps that everybody's using, apps that maybe started as a ride-hailing company, but they were very quick and innovative to adapt to the local population. And now they were so successful that basically they have become also fintech apps offering e-wallets, e-money, and to some extent even microloan and microinsurance services. And why I was saying before that they were very quick in identifying an entrepreneurship opportunity, because when you look at these markets in Southeast Asia, there were large segments in the population that could not access a traditional bank account. And the reason is that this segment of the population were considered too risky to the typical banking establishment, financial institution, because maybe it was people belonging to the informal economy or people that didn't even have a classical address to put, I mean, on the paperwork that you need to fill in to open up a bank account. But at the same time, large segments of the population using a mobile phone, and also younger populations in Southeast Asia compared to North America and Europe. So segment of the population that were very happy to use and adopt digital technologies. So this combination of characteristic made this fintech innovation very successful and useful. And at the same time, these innovations, going back to the question that Marco was asking at the beginning about SDG or sustainability and inclusion, were also a channel to promote more inclusivity in the economy. Because once again, people that could not access a bank account before now basically can use an app on their mobile phone. They can decide to get rid of cash and use more secure forms of payments. And many governments are actually seeing these tools as a way to accompany people towards from the informal economy towards the formal economy. I hope that this partly addresses your question.
Julia, you've raised a number of very interesting points, and the point you made about financial inclusion, so the fact that some of this innovation in emerging markets has allowed the financial system to reach people which were previously unbanked, point to something that perhaps is a more general point, right? The fact that one characteristic of many emerging markets is the weak condition or the total lack of some of the traditional infrastructures that are instead very well developed and articulated in advanced economies. Finance is one example, but energy infrastructure is another one. So do you feel that perhaps in some cases in emerging markets, this becomes toxically an advantage? So it puts emerging markets in a situation where there is a stronger incentive to innovate, but also a stronger incentive to leapfrog from technologies and infrastructure which are already well established in advanced economies to something which is actually more advanced and more efficient and can be deployed in a cost-effective way more rapidly in places where there is nothing else. So there is almost no cost of opportunity. What are your observations on this?
Yes, Mark. I mean, you're raising the issue of the technological innovation leapfrogging. That is something widely known in the economic and innovation literature. And you are absolutely correct. In some cases, in some ecosystem where there is no legacy, there's more space for innovation, and innovation can also happen faster. But now, I mean, because at the beginning I started by describing different innovation ecosystem in different areas of the world, let me perhaps make an example that is outside Asia. It's actually, I mean, coming from Europe. I'm talking about a country that has established itself as a public sector innovation powerhouse, and this country is Estonia. I worked with Estonia many years ago, and the story is very interesting. One of the reasons why Estonia was able to basically build up so many public sector innovative services is precisely because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had to rebuild their own public sector services, the different way, I mean, the government was providing services to citizens, including, I mean, delivering driving licenses or this kind of things. And they decided to go digital in a big way, and they could do it because essentially there was no legacy. There were no pre-made investment that were, in a sense, locking in certain dynamics and certain ways to provide these services. And therefore, I mean, they choose this very innovative path, especially at that time, it was an extremely innovative path. And they were able to build something from scratch that was different from what other European countries were doing. And they managed to do it in a very efficient and innovative way. And this is why, in a sense, I mean, Estonia is widely known globally as an e-gov country, or a country where, again, the digitalization of public services has been at the forefront and has worked very well. And again, the country has established its trademark in this respect. I did it on purpose to highlight an example coming from another region, because this is something that can happen anywhere when there is no legacy and governments, entrepreneurs. I mean, I was making the case. I mean, I was describing what smart startupers could do in Southeast Asia. But you see, I mean, in some cases, the driver for innovation can be the public sector or the government. In other cases, it can be the entrepreneurs. But as Marco, as you were saying, when there is no legacy and there are no pre-established institutions, sometimes the room for maneuver to innovation is bigger.
I have a question along those lines. You mentioned earlier on about an orchestra and, you know, how the different people are acting together to produce the harmony. But I guess my question is, before we get into too much of the detail of the type of innovation, things like that, what exactly is the harmony, I guess, that we're trying to achieve with this ecosystem of innovation? And maybe this is a good place to introduce sustainable development goals. And how does all of this tie to maybe like achieving those goals? The other thing that I want to tie this to is you mentioned super apps, and I'm not sure if you mentioned that as a positive or negative or just a thing that happens, but in terms of the development of super apps and this like organic or emergent innovation in the lack of the way you say that these frameworks and infrastructures, isn't there a risk of repeating maybe the issues with income inequality, income inequities and things like that? So how do you ensure equitable access?
Well, let's start with the part of the question about music and harmony. I guess that depends on which type of music we like. So each ecosystem is different and very much context specific. And it's really shaped by the type of institutions that you have in a specific location. And again, I mean, how, you know, relationship develop amongst these different actors. But again, I mean, so ultimately that's a bit up to what we want to achieve. And once again, I mean, I was mentioning at the beginning policy priorities. So the policy agenda, what governments want to do, has an important role to play in shaping up the type of music we want to be listening, which is perhaps leading us to your part of the question about sustainable development goals. Now, the SDG has been a very successful framework. It was developed by UNDP, and now basically everybody around the globe is using somehow this framework, either governments or different organizations and institutions. And when we talk about innovation and entrepreneurship, we need to be humble in a sense. Innovation and entrepreneurship or startup creation are not the solution to any problem, and they are not the solution to every SDG-related issue or problem. Having said that, they can be part of the solution. And the reason is that if you look at the SDG framework, within the framework, there are lots of very big and complex issues that are listed over there. So many of the solutions still need to be found. And this is really where entrepreneurship, startup creation, and innovation to meet the SDG is something that can and should be very important. And because we do a lot of work with governments in Southeast Asia and even globally, one of our recommendations is really to try to incentivize that type of innovation. Collaboration, for instance, between research organizations and new emerging startups in areas related to green innovations or innovations to promote more inclusion in societies, as you were pointing to. So this is something that we need to remember, and it's important to keep in mind. It's not the only solution, but it can be part of the solution. You were asking me the question about whether super apps or some of the innovations that I'm seeing in Southeast Asia or in other emerging markets are actually a driver of equality and inclusion or inequality. Perhaps my answer is a little bit both, in the sense that I gave you already an example before about fintech and how this could be a channel for inclusion. At the same time, in periods of rapid transformation, there are always winners and losers. Again, in the countries I'm primarily working on in Southeast Asia, this is something that we are seeing very well. On one hand, innovators that are able to seize opportunities like the ones I was just mentioning before, but at the same time, lots of people that are not even yet connected to the internet. There are many rural parts of emerging Asia when this is still the case. And these unconnected people are clearly cut out of the various opportunities offered by digital technologies and the digital revolution. So because we were discussing about the SDGs, it's very important to remember that governments have a role to play in making sure that infrastructure is as much as possible available to many different groups, so that on one hand, they can benefit from these digital innovations we were just describing, and on the other hand, they can also become active innovation players if they want to, if they have the opportunity to. So lots of opportunities, but definitely the inequalities are still there. And because you asked me about it, let me perhaps share a couple of examples from two different countries, India and Brazil, where somehow governments had a role to play in providing infrastructure that turned out to be very useful in driving innovation and make this innovation more inclusive. In the case of India, this is something that is becoming very famous throughout the world, is digital public infrastructure. So the government decided to invest in digital infrastructure open to the public with a model of open innovation that somehow facilitated the development of many different services and business creation around, again, this digital public infrastructure that is now widely used, including in the fintech space. And the Indian government is planning to sign the agreement with different countries around the world to basically make these services available even beyond Indian borders. The other case is the one of Brazil. And once again, we go back to the fintech examples I started to describe before. In this case, one of the leading players was the Brazilian Central Bank through their open banking policy that once again really unleashed a lot of innovation in the fintech space, with lots of new entrepreneurs and startups emerging. And some of this innovation had really a spectacular rate of adoptions. Billions of transactions, millions of users utilizing these different services that once again were clearly seen as something successful that in many cases could really promote inclusion and not just innovation.
These are excellent examples, Julia. I think we should also remember that, you know, the examples you've made, and I would say especially the example of India's government program of launch of a digital infrastructure with financial inclusions and inclusion of public services at the core of it, is a great example of how innovation can be leverage for greater inclusion and more widespread access to opportunity. At the same time, we should also be realistic and remember that sometimes as innovation accelerates economic development, some initial degree of heightening of income disparities is perhaps inevitable and is sometimes a price to pay for accelerated growth that then can spread to the rest of the population. I wanted to get into another issue with you, another question for you, Julia, which is the following. We talked about the different components of the ecosystem and the different role of government, private startups. A crucial element is talent. You talked earlier on about entrepreneurs studying abroad and then coming back into emerging markets to create and deploy innovation. Can you tell us a little bit more of how you see the building up and nurturing of talent for innovation within emerging markets, and perhaps also the role that global communications and global ecosystems play in this?
The issue of talent is absolutely a critical one. And here, I think we can't really characterize in the same way many different emerging markets, because every national and local innovation ecosystem is different. We talked already a lot about the case of Brazil. Brazil is a country where there are leading universities. I think the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil is probably one of the best and strongest in South America. So definitely an institution that is helping to accelerate talent development in the country and on the continent. But this is not the case for other emerging countries, for instance, where I'm based in Southeast Asia. In Southeast Asia, reminding us that we are not talking necessarily about a country like Singapore that is high income, highly developed with leading universities, but definitely domestic talent organization in many countries are still weak. And this is an area where many of the governments in the region really need to think about. And in a sense, they're already thinking about, but it's a long game. I mean, it takes time to really upgrade and strengthen education system from private primary to tertiary education level, which is why, I mean, many countries, on one hand, they really need to try to upgrade education institutions, education and learning institution, and also equip them to really promote more entrepreneurship, innovation, and the development of these ecosystems, because they have potentially a big role to play. But at the same time, I think these countries where learning institutions are weaker, they don't have time to wait until when the education system at all cycle would be completely upgraded and strengthened. So there are also other measures that should be put in place in parallel. For instance, measures that are actually supporting more talent attraction, retention, and also circulation. The mobility of a highly skilled is very important for nurturing and developing innovation ecosystems. A lot of the dynamics that we are talking about today are global dynamics. And this is why connecting local ecosystem with talent from abroad, it's absolutely critical. Some countries have been very successful in connecting a local innovation ecosystem with the global diaspora, and India is definitely one of them. But what we are also observing in many countries in emerging Asia is actually a proliferation of various schemes to attract talent from abroad through entrepreneurship visa, startup visa, to some extent even digital nomad visa. In some cases, they're a little bit controversial, but they can also be used in a successful way to really bring talent into an ecosystem. Let me make an example of an island in Indonesia that is famously known as a leading touristic destination. It is the island of Bali. Everybody knows about Bali for tourism, temples, rice fields. But Bali has seen an increasing flow of talented individuals, especially post-pandemic, that want to go and move to Bali to be digital nomads over there. This also has negative impacts. I mean, congestion and more traffic jam and some locals that are complaining about the fact that prices are going up. Therefore, in a sense, inequality rising, as you, Marco, were just mentioning before. It is somehow disrupting local habits. But on the other hand, this inflow of talented individuals coming from many different locations around the planet, it's really revolutionizing the local economy. To the point, to the extent that now some people talk about Bali as Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley, but Silicon Bali, because these crowds working together in the same location are somehow becoming drivers for entrepreneurship. And some of the venture capitalists in the region are really starting to pay attention to it.
It's very interesting, the point you made about the different kinds of attractors, like the visas and the positive impacts. But you also mentioned some of the, the unintended consequences. Some of the cities and tourist destinations have been hit by, for example, housing shortages, right? So the short-term rental property values go up because of this. There's also complaints that, for example, the money coming in doesn't always stay within the city for development. So there's a potential for a lot of other impacts as well. And I'm wondering, in your view, so we've been talking about, say, education, which is forward-looking. In the next maybe 25 to 50 years, what do you see as maybe unintended consequences that maybe are worrying for you, or that we should be addressing in the work that we're doing in terms of either policy and technology?
Well, I think it is very important to look at these unintended consequences precisely to avoid backlash in the future. I mean, We were discussing before that some of these trends about innovation and technology inevitably are creating winners and losers. And even in the examples I was mentioning before about Bali, not everybody is happy about this transformation, which is why public policy, or I mean, some kind of interventions are very important to make sure that it's not just a parallel economy or a parallel bunch of smart startuppers and entrepreneurs, but somehow, I mean, the local communities are benefiting out of these inflows of talented people coming from abroad. There could be many ways in which these communities or foreign individuals are somehow related and connected to the local education system, so that local families can benefit from some transfer of talent, connections, and competencies. In other cases, it could be policies to actively try to make sure that the local population has access to some of the good jobs brought by these international crowds of innovators, and so on and so forth. And this is something that I think even on the island of Bali, local authorities are aware of. Because when you look at the latest policy developments, and this is something that is not at all related to innovation or technology policy, it's really about, I mean, administering the city or the island to make sure that there is no backlash, and therefore the local economy will be able in the future to diversify more and more from a tourist-based economy to a more knowledge-based or innovation-based economy. So what you are highlighting is very important. And in a sense, I mean, it's a matter of policy complementarities and making sure that when you try to promote the creation of an innovation ecosystem, you also need to make sure that other pieces, other bits and bytes of public policy are also in place.
It's a very interesting point. I'll just make a brief comment on this from my perspective as an economist, because point that you both, Vic and Julia, have made goes to the challenge we now have in finding new models for economic development and economic growth overall. The traditional model used to be you move from an agricultural society to developing manufacturing, and industry manufacturing creates a large number of good paying jobs. You create the middle class, and then you move more into services, and innovation pushes you forward. Now we're in a situation where there is the risk of innovation being so concentrated in some narrow sectors that it becomes harder to see how you extend those benefits. Even India, to some extent, is suffering from that challenge because it has placed most of its bets on services and high-tech services and struggled to create a stronger manufacturing sector. So this is a rather complex problem of how to foster broader economic development through a country, through a society, leveraging innovation so that you can have more broadly distributed growth and not something that is too narrowly concentrated and increasing inequality. So it's just an observation. I definitely don't have the answer. Is there something, Julia, in what you're seeing? You've worked a lot with and you continue to work with pretty much every important and relevant international organization and global initiative. What do you see as the most important role that global initiatives are playing in creating stronger ecosystems and therefore creating the conditions for innovation to be more broadly distributed globally, including in emerging markets, but also being a force for broader good, so to speak?
Thank you for this question. I'm very happy to highlight some of the trends that I've been observing in a number of international fora, including at G20 level. And in a sense, I mean, what I'm about to say is a continuation of the conversation we just had, because even in these international fora, primarily the G20, I think by participating in some of these in this initiative, it's very clear that innovation, startup creation, technology adoption is really a priority for any of the government participating, and not just the US or the European Union for that matter. What was interesting to see to some extent is that leading emerging markets within the G20 actually were some of the proponents of new multilateral fora to discuss innovation and entrepreneurships at G20 level. I started to follow the G20 works on innovation under the G20 Indonesia in 2022. And one of their flagship initiative was something called at the time G20 Digital Innovation Network. So Indonesia really wanted to create a sort of a G20 startup competition where tech-based startups from all G20 countries were meeting in Bali to basically compete and do their own pitches. And what's interesting is that, and that was, you know, I mean, something that the government wanted to promote was selecting entrepreneurs that somehow had developed business models related to the SDG frameworks and in particular the green transformation. After Indonesia, the G20 handed over to India in 2023, last year. And India not only decided to kind of renew this kind of activity, but decided to scale it up. And under G20 India, the India presidency decided to establish a new engagement group dedicated entirely on innovation and entrepreneurship under the G20 that is called Startup 20. Basically, to bring the voice of innovators and innovation ecosystem to the work of the G20. And this is something that then, I mean, Brazil in 2024 decided to confirm, giving even more emphasis on the role that startups and innovation can have for the green transformation, inclusion, for instance, the relationship between startups and innovators and more traditional MSMEs. So even from a global governance perspective, even in times where the phrase itself, global governance, is increasingly something that not everybody is ready to discuss, and it's becoming somehow controversial. But we can see that some big emerging countries, emerging economies, are, if you want, even taking the lead in shaping the conversation about entrepreneurship and innovation in these multilateral fora, which I think is already a signal of the fact of how these are becoming policy priorities for them and of the fact that they increasingly want to really participate and shape the global conversation. There's still a lot of optimism regarding globalization in some of the economies we were just discussing. And this is also why I think they want to play a leading role in shaping these global networks. They know that global networks of talent and innovation can potentially strongly benefit their own domestic ecosystems.
Yeah, really interesting, Julia. So you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to double click on. One of them, so Startup 20, I actually heard some panel sessions of you talking to some of the leaders in this field, and you're talking about, for example, the role of women in entrepreneurship and the specific challenges in some places in South Asia, Southeast Asia. But beyond that, when you talked about, for example, connecting the startup ecosystem to, let's say, SDGs that some countries are doing, how exactly does the ecosystem get input to know that it's going to benefit the community? So I mentioned women as an example, but if you start to talk about inclusion more generally, what are the mechanisms in your economic modeling and in the like the startup, the initiatives that are being proposed and implemented? How are these communities being represented? How are their voices being heard? How is that data coming in? And are these digital tools and digitalization, is it playing a role in this?
Well, I mean, there are many ways to do it, and obviously not every way to do it is successful. But I mean, something that, for instance, was critical for Brazil, and this is why they really wanted under the H20 presidency to highlight the potentially positive relationship between startups and more traditional MSMEs, is something that it's something that has happened very much also in Southeast Asia. Some of the platforms I was describing before as leading platforms in the fintech space were actually very successful in bringing the digital transformation to very traditional micro businesses in different economies. Think about a platform where a very traditional MSMEs can go online, market and sell their own products to an extent that was not possible before. So on one hand, the digital platform needs the traditional MSMEs because they are somehow their customer base, depending, you know, on the different paying models and other characteristics. But at the same time, the traditional MSMEs benefits by participating, by connecting with these startups, because their customer base can improve. In some cases, they can export, they can do different marketing, etc. So this is an interesting dynamic that we have been observing both in Southeast Asia and in other countries. And it's something that, if played out well, can be beneficial and win both for the digital and tech-based startups and the large MSME sector. And let's remember that for many of the countries we were discussing about, the MSME, the micro and small medium enterprises, are the very long tail of firms. Making sure that these companies become even a little bit more productive can be transformational for the economy overall. Then, I mean, you were also asking me about women-led firms or communities of women and how this is related to the SDGs and startup community. It, of course, depends, but there are interesting examples of digital startups that were really targeting different communities of women. In India, for instance, we just concluded a collaboration with one of the UN agencies, UN Trade and Development. And one of the leading speakers at the event we organize in Delhi is an entrepreneur from India that for decades has really worked with communities of women farmers in India to bring them online and connect them to online platforms. So the business model of this entrepreneur was inclusive from day zero. I mean, the goal itself of the business model of the company that she established was really very much about women inclusion, especially. So there are different examples out there, some of them more successful, some of them less successful. But ultimately, it very much depends on the business model and the type of impact that the entrepreneurs establishing a startup wants to deliver. And
very interesting. That sounds very... Oh, go ahead, Julia.
No, another case that perhaps it would be worth mentioning. I recently participated in a study by another agency of the UN, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, FAO. And we tried to understand agri-tech entrepreneurship dynamics in Asia, especially in rural Asia, because this is where, you know, combining agriculture with digital technologies can be transformative. And this is also why it is becoming a priority for many countries in emerging Asia. And they're trying to understand what they can do to promote technology adoption by rural communities across different geographies. But what it was interesting to see is that sometimes, I mean, the business model doesn't need to rely on the most cutting edge type of technology. It doesn't need to be just about artificial intelligence. There are examples of communities of farmers just using digital technologies to share weather forecast, meteorological information, and that can really make their yields much more productive. So there are different ways to develop a business model. It could be more or less technologically intense, but, you know, it can really have an impact when it comes to inclusion of rural communities in different places around the world.
Speaking of impact, so, I mean, you mentioned all these different regional examples, and it seems like going back to our orchestra example that you started us off on, it's a very complex orchestra. And so how exactly do you know that you're hitting the right note? Like, when you're talking about impacts, so what are you, like, how do you measure success? What are you looking for? What kinds of indicators are you looking at?
That's a very tough question. And the reason is that, unfortunately, when we discuss about innovation ecosystem, there are still many dynamics that are very difficult to capture and measure. And this is why even when we started our conversation, I was making the example of global share of patent counts and highlighting the fact that this is an imperfect measure of innovation activities. So there's still a lot to do in terms of trying to identify the best indicators, but also in terms of data collection. What we are observing, for instance, in Southeast Asia is that lots of countries are not collecting the data they would need to monitor and evaluate the way ecosystems are shaping up and developing. So this is something that, on one hand, governments need to invest in, because it will be particularly critical also to understand what's working and what's working less well. But on the other hand, going forward, potentially, there's really an opportunity to partner with the private sector itself, with some of these tech-based companies I was mentioning before, whether foreign or domestic, because they collect, since they're using digital technologies, they collected a lot of data about users, about different trends and dynamics, and therefore they can be proven extremely useful to try to measure different evolutions, different evolutionary dynamics of innovation in different geographies. It's not always easy to obtain this data, but if you ask me, what would be the recommendation for analysts and researchers like me, but also policymakers, would really be, sure, let's try to collect traditional indicators, but this is not enough. We should also partner with the private sector to get access to granular data that could provide and give us a better idea of what's actually going on. And let me add on this something that once again goes back to some of the previous conversations. When I was mentioning about some of the startups in emerging Asia that started as raid hailing companies, and then they moved into the e-wallet, e-money business, and now they're offering micro insurances and micro loans to some of their customer base. Well, they can do it precisely because they have a very data intensive way of working. So because they know very well habits of their customers, I mean, and they also, because they're offering e-wallet and e-money services, they have records of transaction. They can use this data intelligence to assess risk profiles of different individuals. And therefore, they are able to offer services to these very same individuals that traditional bankings would consider too risky, especially when we are talking about microloans and microinsurances. So this is, in a sense, very interesting. Then, I mean, because we are always talking about the opportunities, but also the threats, we should also recognize that this is also opening up potential problems related to privacy, cybersecurity, cyber threats, and more on.
A very, very good point. It also brings to mind another example of the way global cooperations are taking shape. You were mentioning the microfinance, an example of microinsurance provision. And I know that, for example, in Latin America, there have been instances where this has led to collaboration between local tech startups, local networks of sellers and entrepreneurs, and some of the established insurance players who are also eager to leverage these opportunities to broaden their market participation. So it's really been fantastic. I think we're getting close to the end of our allotted time, sadly. Julia, this has been a very rich conversation. We've touched on so much. So on my side, for me, the biggest takeaways I would say are, number one, you've made a very clear and convincing case as to why not only innovation is already moving forward faster than most of us realize in emerging markets, but also as to why this trend will continue and will become even stronger. And secondly, in a situation, in a historical juncture where there is some level of backlash against globalization, it's another way to look at the importance that the global networks, global ecosystems continue to play to strengthen innovation and economic growth globally, and to therefore reinforce the structure of society globally as well. I mean, we've talked about the progress being made to addressing sustainable development goals. We talked about the trade-offs that pertain to more equitable access to financial opportunity and infrastructure in emerging markets. So it's really been a fantastic conversation, and for me, a very positive and inspiring one. Vic, what are your thoughts from the conversation we've had so far?
Thanks, Marco. So similar to yours, I think, so there's a lot of, it seems like there are many diverse initiatives around innovation and creating connections. We call it an ecosystem, but essentially creating more connections between different agents, whether it's universities, people, funding resources, experts. So the one thing that I think throughout this, at least is striking to me, is with the pace at which this innovation is developing, there's, and I think Julia touched on this at the end, a lot of the impact tracing, a lot of the metrics, a lot of the data that's needed to look at how exactly this is impacting the system. And in complex systems, we need feedback loops there seems to be a need for us to create a better mechanism to track the impacts and then to provide a feedback mechanism into the innovation ecosystem. Because right now it seems like we're relying on platforms and the data that they're able to collect. So maybe a more intentional mechanism to provide that feedback, but seems like a lot of positive developments in that direction.
It's a very good point. And Julia, before we let you go, anything that we should have covered but have not, or any last message, anything that you really would like our audience to take away from this conversation?
Thank you, Marco. Let me be very brief. We are, I think, at the end of our time together. But yeah, let me perhaps continue from what you were saying. So we discussed a lot about what's happening in different emerging markets around the world. And I think it's very important for our listeners today to keep in mind that innovation is alive and kicking across many different geographies. And my prediction is that it will continue to be like that in the years to come, perhaps even more so. Of course, I mean, everybody should look at what's happening in California and in many locations in Europe, but it's not either or. I think that for many innovation watchers, it's equally important to understand these dynamics, this diverse and emerging geography of innovation that exists also outside North America and Europe, because we really need to be aware of these trends, also to try to understand what opportunities are out there.
That's a perfect note to end on. Julia, thank you so much for being with us today. Vic, thanks for co-hosting. This was a fantastic conversation. It was great to have somebody like Dr. Julia Aimone-Marsan, somebody who is an innovation expert with outstanding on-the-ground experience, not only in emerging markets themselves, but with all sorts of international organizations that are involved in fostering innovation globally. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.